This is KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula.
In this special edition of The Compass, we'll talk with Shannon Kring, director of End of the Line, The Women of Standing Rock, one of the films selected for screening at this year's 22nd annual Port Townsend Film Festival. Shannon and her crew have woven together a significant chronicle of the grassroots movement that arose after it was announced that the Dakota Access Pipeline would be routed through the land of the indigenous people of South Dakota. It tells the story of the four brave women who started it all, with four Mongolian yurts and four families camped on the grasslands overlooking the proposed pipeline route, as workers move closer to the sacred sites of Lakota Territory and the banks of the Missouri River. And now, let's go inside the compass.
For years, people have fought this struggle, fought for our land and water. And I was at a point where I felt like nobody cared. We're just people from here that stood up and asked everybody to come and stand with us. And they did.
Criminals! You guys are criminals!
The original pipeline was to go through North Dakota, but it was going through white people's land. So they redirected it, put it through the Indians.
What it all comes down to is wanting clean drinking water for our children.
One family. If we don't stand, we will.
And we are peaceful, prayerful people. But it's come to a point now where enough is enough.
Shannon Kring, director of End of the Line, The Women of Standing Rock. Welcome to the 22nd annual Port Townsend Film Festival.
Thank you so much.
You were there from the beginning. How did this all start for you?
I wasn't there from the very beginning, but I was there when the numbers were quite small, maybe 1,500, 2,000 people, which was middle of the summer. And I actually received what I can only call a calling beyond that which LaDonna Brave Bull Allard put out for people to come and join them at Standing Rock. I was working and living in Honduras, of all places, covering similar stories there about land rights abuses and their nine indigenous groups. And I'd been there for about 2.5 years, I guess, full time. And my parents were sending me some video links from Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Footage. I was really shocked at how similar it was to what I was facing in Latin America. You know, you expect that in other countries. I've worked all around the world on these issues. To see it play out in the U.S., I know these things happen, but to actually witness it and have such blatant abuses of power playing out in front of people who were very obviously live streaming stunned me. And so it was really one of those things where I watched a video and it was roughly 24 hours later, Pearl Daniel Means, my co-producer, Mark Gerke, our cinematographer, and I were on the ground. And I did not know that women were running everything out there. So I never intended to just tell the story of the women. But after one day of filming, it became clear to me that the women were really the backbone of the movement. And so I stayed with them throughout. And I actually covered them for more than 2.5 years. I didn't stop rolling once everyone else went away. Because to me, what was at least as fascinating is, what are these people going to do now? They go back to their homes after having been thrust into the international consciousness. And what is their life at that point?
Thrown into the international consciousness. And when there was a gathering of more than half of the tribes that exist in the United States were represented there. I think, what was it, like 350 or something like that?
Actually, 419.
People
say 411, but let's just say around that ballpark. But and they all signed in, and so it was really neat for me to see that. And of course, you were there, so you got to witness the flags. I thought that that was really an awesome display of solidarity to see all of these flags. And I can remember in the beginning, people had these nice flag poles and they were all hung in such an orderly fashion. By the end, guys were sawing off PVC pipe, you know, to make the flag poles. That's how many people came out to show their solidarity.
That was just an amazing sight, just that whole panorama, because it was just this big blanket of homemade shelters and teepees and flags flying everywhere and signs all along as we came to the entrance of the camp. It was pretty impressive.
When I arrived, I think there were about three of us there. Organizations by the end, 36 had signed in. And so eventually it gained momentum. Making films in remote places comes with all sorts of challenges, not the least of which in this case was protecting our footage. We had to drive sometimes an hour and a half, even more, one way in order to ship our footage to various safe locations, because footage was being seized. People's cameras were being taken and drones were being shot down, you name it. There are a lot of people who did not want this story to be told.
That's very true. Your remark about women being the backbone of the movement, the one thing in the history of the labor movement, for example, is that women were the backbone.
That's right. If you look at the Chicano movement, for instance, if you look at present day migrant farming issues in Latin America, mining rights, logging issues, it's usually the women. And in the case of Standing Rock, it was the women, because in the native North American traditions, the women bear life in water within their bodies. And so the women, as I was explained, are the guardians of the water, and the men are the protectors of the women in doing their work with the water. And so I had quite a few men who said, you know, I won't speak to water. That's not my area. That's for women to talk about. But they would talk about how they were supporting the women. And this really did start with just a handful of women. We actually interviewed and stayed with for 2.5 years, 4 out of the 5 original water protectors out at Standing Rock. And actually, the whistle was first blown by one of our lead characters, Washtewe Young. Washtewe's a mother of 4 children, and she's now in law school. This whole event led her to study law to try to protect her people in a greater way. But it really started with her when she was working in the Tribal Historic Preservation Office. And back in September of 2014, she went before the tribe and said, look, we're getting these notices from this Energy Transfer Partners about this Dakota Access Pipeline. And so far as I can see, they're not following any of the protocol that they should be in terms of the environmental surveys, that sort of thing. So she was the first whistleblower and one of the first people out to take a stand. And she was initially reluctant to allow us to turn the cameras on her. But I cannot imagine this film or the movement without her participation.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the whole idea of gaining credibility and trust as a documentarian. I think that's really important. And it takes time. You can't hurry that.
Well, a lot of people try, you know, that's one of my frustrations because of the places where I work. I see it a lot. People show up, you know, for 3-4 days and release a story without any consent, without doing the proper greetings, without honoring the land in the way that they're supposed to. But really, it's important to have the participation. And in my case, I believe in getting the blessings of the elders, not just the people who are going to be on camera. I understand that in indigenous cultures around the world, the elders need to bless things. And so I announced my arrival as quickly as I could. I was really lucky in that I've been working with North American Indians now since I was a teenager. That's a long time ago. And I had a connection to the Lakota through Pearl, my co-producer. And Pearl Means was married to Russell Means, the amazing Lakota freedom fighter, as they call him. And I was incredibly honored to conduct Russell's last documentary interview at the end of his life. That's how I met Pearl. We became truly sisters. And because I had done that interview and the women at Standing Rock, the leadership, were sisters of Russell's, that went far. But still, I felt the need to really earn the trust and continue to earn the trust. And yes, it is a long process, and it should be, right? People who look like me, who come from white westernized society, have been doing heinous things to these people for more than 525 years. And there's always that, hey, you can trust me attitude. Actually, when people trust me immediately, I kind of want to shake them and say, please don't trust everyone who comes from the outside, because there are not always the best intentions. My intention was always to have them tell their story, whatever that story is that they wanted it to be. For instance, for it to be all about the women, you know, that was the idea of the women and happened organically. And so this is not about me, and it should never be about the filmmaker.
Tell me about your co-producer, Pearl, just briefly.
So Pearl is an amazing woman. She is actually Dene, called Navajo by most, and she comes from the Salt Tribe. She was adopted by the Lakota people and, yes, walked alongside Russell as his business manager, his business partner, really handled all of the day-to-day of all of Russell's many engagements, and was there for many years with him as he worked against injustices. I was really nervous to meet both of them initially, which was in 2010. I was really nervous to interview Russell. I saw interviews online where he took off his mic pack and said, this is a stupid question, and things like that. But Pearl is a wonderful, warm person. We also have co-producers in Finland, of all places, including Sofia Ehrenruth, who's my producer, my partner in Finland. And Sofia and I have been working together since 2008. And it was Sofia who really helped open doors in Finland to get the backing of the Finnish Film Foundation, YLE, the very prestigious national broadcaster of Finland, and others, Solar Films, and others who really joined us in getting this story out.
Getting the story out, when you say that you got funding in Finland, but you didn't have quite that kind of success here, production-wise, in getting some kind of a foundational way of proceeding.
Yeah, in the U.S., I knew we were not going to get instant backing. Look, we're taking on some tough topics. We were taking on the topics of abuses within the military, within law enforcement. We were looking at issues like forced sterilization, the boarding school atrocities, foster care system abuses, on and on, the medical system failures for Native Americans, etc. And of course, the treaty violations of the U.S. government. I knew that this was not going to get a lot of support in the U.S. initially. I got literally thousands of threats and nasty emails and posts on my social media. So I knew we had to go elsewhere. And so put up a crowdfunding campaign. We ended up getting donations from, I think, 47, 48 countries, and then went to Finland and really appealed to the Finnish production system. And I was really just overjoyed with the support we received there. They were very active producers. You know, our music composition took part largely there. Editing, color, sound, and the women were there. They welcomed the women of Standing Rock in such a beautiful way. You know, a lot of these women, it took a lot to get them to Finland. We were doing everything financially to get them there. They didn't have passports. One of them, Lula Red Cloud, had never left the Lakota lands. You know, to have them come over to Finland and to speak at the university and to have hundreds of people show up to listen to them was really meaningful. And it would be another more than 2 years before we would get that in the United States. I'm surprised now that we're starting to get some really beautiful support here.
I was in Finland as well, and the Finns are very warm and sincere. But I want to get on to your crew.
We had Mark Gerke, a wonderful photographer, and I'd worked with Mark in Honduras. He's from Chicago, but I worked with him in Honduras. And the reason why he was the first person that I called in terms of crew is because he has respect for people. As I mentioned, it's really important how you show up in these lands. And I knew he would be just extremely respectful and really unobtrusive. And so that was important. In the beginning, it was really just Mark, Pearl, and myself. And it was like that until we raised more money. And then I was able to bring on someone named Nara Garber, an amazing woman who's covered Indigenous issues. She's an Asian American, and she's covered a lot of topics, especially in Alaska with their struggles there. Bing Liu also did some camera work. Bing has received so much success in the last couple of years for his Minding the Gap film and his Oscar nomination. And so he was there with me in Denver, covering the incredible story of Sky Roosevelt Morris, who talks about the effects of colonialism on families. And yeah, then some Finns. We actually had two people from Honduras who joined us, you know, a couple more from Chicago. And we took what we could. On some of the really important dates, I wanted to have at least two cameras and a proper sound person. And so we were really blessed to have people who believed in the project enough to come out and, you know, get shot at and get maybe spit on and get hypothermia potentially, et cetera.
The historical passive trauma with old photographs and really the haunting camera work in the abandoned boarding schools. It was all nicely woven together.
That was a horrible experience. You know, the boarding school atrocities are just coming to light in the mainstream now, but I've been visiting these places for well more than a decade now. I've visited the cemeteries, and it's a horrible thing. That's covered in our film quite extensively. And the reason is I wanted for people to understand that this wasn't just about one pipeline and one violation of rights of an Indigenous people. I wanted to give it the historic context and also to explain what's happening in a modern day Indian country. And that was really important for Pearl and me and for all of us to get that story out there in a good way. And yes, the editing is beautiful in addition to the camera work. That was not easy because in the end, we ended up with hundreds of hours of footage. Probably going to ask something to the effect of, how did you decide what would go in there? I wanted to really give it the historic context and take those hundreds of hours of footage and really follow a through line of some key women. Documentaries are notorious for having one or two stars, and because the belief is that it's really confusing to follow more people than that. And I stuck to my guns, and I'm really glad in that I refused to cut out more people than I did. I'm really brokenhearted over who I had to cut out because I followed other amazing women, and I will get those stories out. But I really had to stick to the story as best I could to try to weave together the historical footage and photos and context with the modern day atrocities. And then what happened after Standing Rock? We had two outstanding editors, primarily Joona Luhavuori, who's in Finland. He got it started, and then we took it back to the US. And Leslie Kubistal stayed on this project. She is still on this project. We are still working on various aspects of it, but she's been with it from the beginning, editing our little pieces for crowdfunding onto the last footage. Then we sent it back to Finland and did offline editing there. And so a lot of hands have touched this. And we're really proud of the finished project, but even more proud of these women and what they've done and what they continue to do to fight for all of our land and water.
Shannon, when we're talking about fighting for the rights of Indigenous people, there were a number of confrontations that happened there at Standing Rock when you talked about taking the precautions to protect your footage. I didn't take that lightly because we got there. I came over there on the Chautauqua bus, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
The new old time Chautauqua. We got there just after the confrontation early in the morning in 20 degree weather, where the water cannons were going off on the activists and the water protectors. The rubber bullet guns were aimed at a part of the torso that they're not supposed to aim at.
Yes, Vanessa Susie Dundon, who's in our film. In the case of Susie, there's audio that says, let's get that, and said a horrible four-letter word referring to a female. Let's get her. And they shot her at point blank range in the eye. It was deliberate. That's on camera. There were a lot of other things that we captured on camera, some that we put in the film, some that we didn't. And there was just a lot of really disgusting things that took place there. And so, you know, protecting the identity of the women was really important to us as well, because, you know, they were already targets for their leadership leadership work there, you know, and I didn't want people to know where they were located at camp, after camp closed, where their houses were. And so we had people following us all the time. And sometimes other filmmakers trying to get the story. But a lot of time, it was a lot of unmarked cars. I was interrogated. I had a lot of, you know, yeah, let's just say brushes with law enforcement questioning me a lot. But I was really lucky in that I did not have my cameras seized or the footage, but I knew better. You know, I'd worked in these areas before, as I mentioned, and so I took the precautions. Unfortunately, not everyone was as lucky.
I talked to some of the medics afterwards. I don't know how many people were injured, but there were a good number of people that were injured or at least came through affected by the whole experience. But the strength of the people there was quite impressive. The whole organization at the camp was quite impressive. And the emphasis on all of the people coming into the camp that might have been either naive or there possibly for maybe the wrong reasons were oriented towards their role in this whole thing as allies, not white people coming in to seize the day, right?
Yes, definitely. That does happen. And, you know, there wasn't that much of it out at Standing Rock, or at least they didn't have the access that others did, maybe. And there were a lot of people who came with really good intentions. I can remember it was probably early September, and it was probably the best morale at camp. It was beautiful weather. And I remember this man, 94 years old, who came from Michigan. He was not native and he was a widow and, you know, just decided to, or widower rather, came out and just decided to show his support. And I met a lot of people like that. You know, people came from Scandinavia and Peru and all over, and not everyone had been a part of an action before. And so one of the things that took place was training sessions. I thought that was just outstanding.
That's what I was getting at. They were outstanding.
Yeah. And really train them on how to do things. And then for the children, because there were children there, they were getting educated. There was a school. They were actually being taught by teachers and learning the ways of the land and about the indigenous plant life there and getting training, how to be safe and things like that. It was really, you know, as violent and awful as it was, on one hand, the camaraderie and the love and support that I felt there was something I've never felt in my life and probably never will again. And we all talk about that today, what it felt like to be there. You know, it gives me goosebumps now just talking about it.
We brought 300 pounds of salmon from the Northwest.
Oh, wow.
And we must have fed 1,000 people over a couple of days. But it was interesting for me because I was covering radio to go around and speak to all of the people that were coming through the line, where they were from, what they were doing, why they were there. And it was a pretty beautiful experience. It was life-changing for me.
Yes. And that's what we hear from a lot of people, that it really changed the whole course of their life. And now they ask, how can I be of service? What can I do now? Because I know that for a lot of the people who came from the outside in particular, they felt a letdown. Afterwards, like, okay, well, we weren't successful. Well, if you judge it by, is there oil flowing through the pipeline? Were you successful? No, not under that. Did you inspire people around the world to take a stand in their own communities, in their own countries? Yes. Are you still getting this into the headlines? Yes. Are you getting additional indigenous issues in the forefront? Yes. And not to mention the divestment. We give a stat at the end that the women of Standing Rock are part of this growing global community that has successfully got $11.94 trillion in divestment commitments at the time of the completion of the film. I don't know what they're at now, but you have to understand that these women and men are so resourceful that they were cashing in change and selling their traditional ribbon skirts, selling rifles, you name it, selling it to get air tickets, to get on the floor at some of these banks, to meet with Swiss Bank or to go to Norway and meet with their bank, the first big national bank to pull out their fossil fuel funding and DAPL funding. It wasn't easy. We did the same to go to Cannes Film Festival. We were told by Cannes Film Festival programmer, said, you know, like, oh, it's a great film. And if you ladies can get an A-list man to vouch for you, we'll take it in the festival. And I said, and if not, they're like, nah, we can't take it. It's all women. Okay, great. So we actually pooled our funds and we showed up and we got attention there because the women were like, no, we're going to this programmer luncheon, and got up there and actually took the microphone and explained our plight. We got a deal out of that. We got a lot of attention in the trade publications, and it has resulted in us getting picked up on TV. We've had to get really creative with how we get this film out there. And we've not even made even the slightest footprint that we want to with it, because this is truly an excellent film. These people deserve to have their stories told. And we're going to do everything we can now to raise funds for an impact marketing campaign to get this into the school systems. This isn't a film that you just make and let it sit. I've been on this for more than 5 years now. And it's really important to all of us. And these women have become family. We are truly family now. In terms of people who are looking for what can they do today, there is so much that can be done to support this cause. This isn't over yet. If we look at other pipeline battles that are happening, this was one of 55 pipelines that were being fought at the time of Standing Rock. And so you can go on websites such as Lakota People's Law Project. You can go on their website. You can go on eartotheground.foundation. That's our foundation. And we are raising money for specifically women issues dealing with protests. For instance, we're raising money to treat women who are suffering from post-traumatic stress from Standing Rock and other actions that have been taken, things like that. You can go on to Earth Justice, the attorneys who are still working on this case. They post regular updates. And of course, our End of the Line page, endofthelinefilm.com is our website. And we are really active on Facebook. I'm always working on something, but I will probably forever work within the space of people who are not blessed to be born with the privileges that I've been just because I was born white. It's really important for me for these stories to get out there and to give these people the platform. You know, people will say like, oh, it's so wonderful you're giving people like this a voice. I'm actually not giving them a voice. They have a voice. It's just that we haven't been listening. And I think that when we look at climate change, et cetera, it's about time we start listening to people who still are in touch with the natural world in ways that unfortunately we have lost.
Well, Shannon Kring, Director of End of the Line, Women of Standing Rock, thank you so much for joining us for the 22nd annual Port Townsend Film Festival. Of course, the festival is running September 22nd through October 3rd.
Thanks for going to Standing Rock.
Mini Wachoni.
We're still going to pursue the legal avenues. I have to leave a footprint.
People, hold your ground. Change is coming now.
The rhetoric is over. It's time for action.
This week's Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker. The Compass airs Saturday at noon and repeats the following Monday at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream live 24 hours a day. Executive producer for Compass is Steve Evans. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, this is Chris Bricker.